Hello, I'm Alex Goldstein.
And I'm Alex Totoro.
We're a couple of TV nerds with opinions, and this is The Thing That Gets You to The Thing, a Halt and Catch Fire fan podcast.
Today we're on Season 2, Episode 2, called New Coke, which puts us somewhere around 1985.
As a quick reminder, in case you're new here, we're going episode by episode through the best show no one seems to have watched, delving around in everything we find interesting about it, from writing to lighting.
Okay then. Let's see if we like the taste of something new.
So before we get into the episode, I should say I am old enough to remember New Coke, as in I was around when it happened and I would have been about 5. I don't remember anything about it. Not one tiny little bit.
I was -5, so I couldn't help you there.
No, it's obviously this thing that for a while became synonymous. Obviously, we both work in marketing, so we've all heard it before. It's became this thing which is synonymous with, you know, don't change a good thing. If you're onto a good thing, don't mess around with it. But no, don't remember it. Don't remember it IRL at all.
What I didn't remember IRL either was that the show would actually admit and kind of expose the cocaine problem like this with Gordon, because it was mentioned last episode, wasn't it? Around like with the doctor. I didn't remember that. And you can tell because if you go back to listen to our Season 1 podcast, you would see that we're sort of wondering what's going on with Gordon. Is it something psychological? We did mention, was it the coke that was kind of like spoken about very like, not like this.
Sort of, yeah, not I, like I this. Didn't remember this being... I didn't remember it being as overt as this at all. And what I love about the show, and I think, you know, without giving away things that I do remember from further down, what I love about it is extremely good at laying a breadcrumb and then picking it up miles down the road and sort of unfolding that something has been happening gradually in the background for as long as you've been watching. And if you'd paid attention, you would have seen. And we have been paying attention. I mean, like, who pays attention more than two people who are watching a show to record a podcast about it later? But somehow, you know, even we just miss some of the groundwork. And, you know, I was thinking to myself, you know, being super critical about it. Is it just that they've suddenly remembered as well and picked something up? But no, if you go back, you find little things that tell you this has been happening the whole time. Yeah. This is a planned thing. This is a thing that they have thought about. And that's part of what I find incredibly clever about. That was one of the, I thought, in an episode that I have sort of good and mixed feelings about, I thought that was one of the really strong things.
Sort of wonder if some of this was done to continue to highlight the fact that Don and Gordon have sort of switched roles to the point where she's really disengaged and distant with him, kind of like how he was with her, just because of work. So she just can't be bothered, and, you know, she can't be in, like, yeah, she's disengaged. And so I wonder if something like this happening right under her nose is more fuel to that fire on top of all these other things that, you know, we're talking about.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that was sort of classic in the original Gordon-Donna relationship is that he was oblivious to much of her life. He was oblivious to what was going on at work. He was oblivious to this sort of rumbling feelings with Hunt. He was kind of oblivious to how unhappy and unsettled and unfulfilled she was in her life. And now she kind of isn't registering anything that's happening in Gordon's world at all. Or if she does, she doesn't really care about it for very long. I thought it was really interesting that, I know I harp on about colors in this program a lot, but she was back in kind of Cameron red.
She's back.
She's back in red. And in the whole first season, she was always in these kind of muted pinky, beigey, salmon shades. And now she's in much stronger colors. Pitch scene aside, and we can come to that in a minute, she is in much more relaxed clothing as well. She's an engineer getting things done mode. And it's interesting because, again, she's kind of swapped with Gordon, because Gordon was always sort of slightly slobby and now is, you know, was for a while inching towards suits, like when he went up to when he turned up to collect his check. And now he's struggling to find, I think, his aesthetic. Like, is he totally relaxed or is he dressed up?
And where do you belong, right? Because I feel like Donna belongs in sort of those suits in those boardrooms where she can pitch her great ideas. Yeah. And Gordon kind of belongs in the garage. Yeah. Playing around and doing coke.
Well, sort of sticking with the because we seem to have gone straight on Donna and Gordon. Let's stick with that.
But first I want to know, did you like the episode?
Yes. I didn't think it was an all-time great. It was packed with stuff. Like, there was a lot of stuff going on. A lot of stuff gets revealed. A lot of stuff happens. There's plot. But I felt that it didn't maybe have as much momentum as some of the other episodes. And I wasn't really sure why. Maybe it was just the case that there was just a lot to unpack and therefore there wasn't time to kind of feel the build with a particular story or strand. But I wrote down a lot in terms of notes, like a lot of is happening here. Well, what I should say is this is one of the rare occasions with this podcast, because I don't think it's happened before, where I watched two episodes back to back.
Yeah, same here.
The whole point of the podcast was that actually we're going to slow it down, watch it one at a time. But for various reasons, it's taken us a while to get kind of season two back together again. I thought, okay, I'm just going to watch back to back. But it wasn't because I got to the end of this episode and was like, oh, I must know what happens next. It was simply because, oh God, I'm going to run out of time. I need to watch this quickly and make some notes. And I don't know why I didn't get to the end of this and go, come on, let's find out what's happening next. Because I do often feel that with the show.
I have the same feelings, actually. I wasn't particularly entertained as much as I would have been on some of the other episodes. I don't know if, and we'll dive deep into this, I don't know if it's, again, the characters are sort of separated and not in ways that they're engaging with each other, like we saw in episode one of this season. The pacing, I think, kind of wasn't there to an extent. Like, I kept checking and I was like, oh, right, there's still like an act left here and we still haven't gotten to the bottom of this and that. I think a lot of the times when since we've been rewatching the show, a lot of the times where the episodes feel like this, it's when the main goal isn't necessarily laid out in a way that guides you through those big plot points. And so things kind of feel random, or they kind of feel like they're shifting back and forth. And I find this a lot with Cameron and Donna, where we're just like, so like, what are you now? Right. And I think we're going to, we're not going to spoil anything, but it feels like we're going to see a lot of that this season.
Yes. And I will say that this particular episode had a lot to do. So just thinking about the title New Coke for a second. So about trying something new, that could be, Joe. I feel like it's supposed to be about Joe and the kind of new Joe that we're seeing. But also in the context of Joe being over here and Donna and Cameron being over there and Gordon trying to find his way over here, we're also picking up a lot of other characters. So we've got the reintroduction of Boz as well. So we're picking up a lot of other characters and getting to know a lot of other characters that we didn't know very well before. So we're getting more of Lev and Yo-Yo. And Lev being actually kind of awful.
Cruel.
Cruel, which is unexpected because he was always a little bit of a kind of whiny child, but you'd not seen him being outright unpleasant before. So you're getting more of them. You're getting more of the kind of mutiny guys. You get the entrance of Tom, who is brand new to us for this season and is clearly, like, again, not to give anything away further down the line, but you can see the strands of longevity here. This guy's going to show up again. So we're kind of getting to know him. We're getting to know Sarah still. She's been introduced in the last episode, but we barely know her yet. And now we know her not just in the context of her relationship to Joe, but also her dad. And I'm sorry, but you don't hire James Cromwell to show up in one episode. So clearly, you know, Jacob Wheeler is going to be somebody that we're going to have to deal with. And I just love that they hired the only actor in the world who can look down on Lee Pace. Like, who is...
Oh, I have some thoughts on Lee Pace's height throughout the
episode.
God,
the fact that, you know, they're in this aircraft hangar, which is massive, and he still looks like the tallest man on Earth, and then they get the even taller man to look down on him. It's incredible. So there's... I think this is an episode where they're going, okay, we're going to widen our horizons a little bit here. Stay with us. We're going to bring in some more people. We're going to bring in some more dynamics, while at the same time still playing with this core dynamic of who are these four people and how do they fit into each other's lives. And, you know, they're struggling a bit, not in a bad way, but I think they're playing with Donna and Cameron and trying to work out how you can, you know, for Cameron in particular, who is a character who shuts down connections, trying to find the places where she opens up is really interesting because they've had the slightly sort of romantic sexual one with Joe. They've shut that back down. Now it's like, well, what is her connection to Donna? What is it that draws her to working with Donna? Why did she ask Donna to come on board in the first place? When it feels like they're at cross purposes a lot. It feels like Donna has taken the Gordon role to Cameron's Joe. And it's like, you know, where are the connections there? But then also, why is she so sort of fascinated, irritated by this Tom guy? Like, what's going on with that? And then finally, of course, the strand that connects her to Boz and the realization that Cameron isn't even her name.
I know. So. I mean, there's a lot of maybe masks not coming off, but maybe starting to melt a little bit just because of all these revelations. And again, they're not big revelations, but they're kind of these breadcrumbs that you were talking about and how the characters kind of have no choice really but to expose themselves. And I guess what I took issue with is that I completely get the potential Cameron-Donna dynamic, and it's going to shift back and forth, and we're going to see this happen via different milestones, right? That's the point. They're building this thing, and they're going to have challenges. Otherwise, we wouldn't be watching a show about it. But they change so much from the beginning of the episode to the end of the episode where you're like, but you literally had this conversation 20 minutes ago, and you're now back to this weird dynamic, and then you're buddying up. Like, that's the bit that really irritates me, because you don't allow them to settle and establish something so that it's more meaningful when they eventually break it.
In some ways, I did actually quite like that. I like the fact that their argument is already circular, because that's real life, isn't it? Right? You have an argument with somebody, you go, okay, I'm going to try and do this. I'm going to try and do that. I'm going to try not, you know, I'm going to try and put the toilet seat down. And then you just go ahead and do it anyway. And I love that Cameron's olive branch is really obviously fake. Like, when she comes to Donna and sort of pretends that she hasn't already hired Tom. And I love that Donna has absolutely no intention of falling for it. Like, she's just like, she sees straight through. Yeah. She's got kids. She knows when kids are playing. She knows, you know.
She's got a Gordon.
She's got a Gordon, and she knows Cameron well enough by now to go, okay, well, this is clearly BS. But I kind of loved that already we've got a sense of two people who are going to keep making promises to each other that neither of them has really any intention of keeping. And I think in some ways, Donna is more sincere, because actually all she wants is the freedom to invest in the community project, which clearly bores Cameron to death. But, you know, we know from the benefit of, you know, being in 2021 that community is going to be a big deal. So we know that Donna's onto something.
Yeah.
Whether or not it's the right time for her to be into it, because that's another thing with tech. All ideas are good ideas. It's whether or not their time has come. So it may not be the time for community yet, but we know with the benefit of hindsight that it could be.
No, and we're being told by someone like Tom that actually her games are not up to snuff with the competition. And so there's also no signal there to say you got to shift gears and maybe try a different direction. And then you're not getting the funding.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really interesting that Cameron's objection to Tom's points that he raises, which are maybe fair, is she says sprinkling fairy dust on what someone else has created. Like, she has a real, like, aesthetic objection to anyone taking a good idea and making it more palatable, which in some ways is an absolute reflection of what Mac did to the giant, right? Same ideas, but Mac sprinkled on the fairy dust. That's what she did, in a way. She sprinkled the fairy dust into the giant and it got taken away. She is so burnt from what happened with Joe. And that's the crux of her issues with Joe, isn't it? She's like, you know, it wasn't a heartbeat, it was an echo. Now it's, oh, you're just sprinkling fairy dust on my original ideas. Like, she absolutely has to believe that her ideas are new and original and unique, and that no one else can really understand them as deeply as she does. And I think she, you know, the fact that Tom, who doesn't know anyone there, clearly admires what she's done, right? Is clearly interested in it. To have gone to the trouble to be this much of an ass about it and then signed his name to it because he wants the attention, he wants to be noticed for it, he wants to work with them. With all that, something about what he's saying is getting to her. Clearly she understands that there is a problem, but she's just desperate to be new and to stand out. Whereas I think what Donna has cottoned on to is the thing that gets you to the thing, right? She is building literally that platform for people to do their own thing. Like, she, a bit like Gordon, wants to create the platform that lets you do whatever you want. Like, what you do creatively after that is nothing to do with her. Whereas, you know, Cameron is in the grip of the kind of, but I must create. I must, you know, obviously create.
And you see this with the updated chapters of the game, where even the sort of potential investor is like, yeah, my nephew played it or something. And it's like, oh yeah, this was just remodeled and repackaged. And you have that sort of dynamic there also with Tom. And we go back to what we were saying last episode around the tiredness, the lack of innovation, and what spark they require. Because if you think back on the end of season one, she created this thing out of nothing from those experiences that burned her. And so what does she need now to continue pushing that forward? And something that we must recognize in Cameron is that she hasn't bailed on this, right? I mean, she could have easily, from that point of view, been a child and said, this is too hard, we're shutting down, I'm going to go back to doing stuff on my own, bye. She's sticking with it one way or another, and there's something to be said about that.
And as pissed off as she is with Tom, there is a glow of realization there. So, like, literally, actually, when she's talking to Tom, I think it's on the doorstep, and she sort of gets an inkling about what the range of his abilities, like what he can actually do. The light on her face sort of goes red. Like, there's a red glow on her face, and it's like she's getting that little bit of spark back. So, you know, the biggest sign of Cameron's growth as a person, and I mean, I think sometimes you're supposed to think it's things like her relationship with Boz, but actually the biggest sign of growth for Cameron is when someone challenges her and she gives herself enough room to breathe and then comes back and goes, okay, well, come and challenge me some more then. She can only do it on her terms. She can only accept so much challenge at a time. She has to go away and throw a tantrum and get over herself first. Yeah. But it's a big sign of growth for her that she's going, okay, if you're so smart, bring it.
That's really interesting. And I think the dynamic with Boz probably is just like a safe space more than an area sort of encourages growth. And again, we only truly find things out. The fact that her father died, the fact that her name is actually not Cameron, but Catherine.
No, but I mean, actually, all those revelations about her family and her father only really come out when she's talking to older men. So
to father figures, right? Yeah.
To father figures, to men who have grown up sons.
Yeah.
Because she did that with Joe's dad, and now she's doing it with Boz. And it is a really interesting thing that, I mean, like, obviously Joe is that little bit older than her, and maybe he was hinted at that relationship and then she couldn't find that in him. And now there isn't a sort of, there's no romantic tension to her relationship with Boz whatsoever. It is very clearly like familial. She is very clearly slotting into a kind of loving daughter role, which I find really interesting. And I have to say, one thing I did like was, so Boz's entrance, and he sort of limps in with his cane. And then I loved the whole Willy Wonka-ness of that, like big time. I loved the kind of Gene Wilder take on, like, I'm going to hobble in and then seem perfect. And the fact that it's sort of in all of that, it was just such a lovely, aside from the fact that it was a kind of great callback to a kind of classic moment, it really highlighted that the little fractures between Cameron and Donna haven't really healed. So they had this reckoning in the last episode. They had this moment at the end where it was like, okay, we're going to do this together. But actually, we know from Boz's entrance, which is really early on in the episode, that there's still too much that they're not telling each other. There's still too much that they're not agreeing beforehand. And Boz's entrance was just a lovely way of highlighting that, while at the same time, just a nice little callback.
Yeah, I really like that. And I wrote down, now I was wondering, is this Boz and Donna's first interaction, like proper interaction?
Maybe, because I wrote down, I will find the note, Donna and Boz don't really have a history, so there's nothing they can really say to each other.
I'm sure that from off screen they do, because if Gordon had been working at Cardiff for, like, you know, 2 decades and or whatever, certainly more than a decade, and Boz had been there for 2 decades, I'm sure there's something. But you're right, it doesn't necessarily mean any connection
Yeah, they'll have been at the events. They'll have been, you know, she'll have been aware of him. But then Gordon and Boz didn't have a particularly close relationship at Cardiff. It wasn't until Gordon kind of came on board leading the Giant Project under Joe that they were forced together more. I got the impression that Boz was much more sales end, Gordon was much more engineering end. And, you know, they didn't really deal with each other a whole lot if they didn't have to. It was Joe that kind of forced that closeness. But it's not emotional closeness. It is work closeness. And they don't have a friendship to speak of. Like, Gordon isn't ringing Boz to go, how you doing, man?
And I wonder where this is going to take Donna from that point of view. Like, could this be someone that Donna can lean on in different ways than Cameron?
Yeah.
Sometimes I also get the impression, and you can see it in this episode, that actually Cameron and Boz have this special father-daughter kind of relationship. But actually, it doesn't do him any favors in the end. Like, he still needs to get out of that to find opportunities kind of elsewhere, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think for him it is lovely and it's comforting, but it isn't, he wants to be practical. He's a practical guy, right? He's a sales guy. He's used to talking a lot of BS, but he had a practical goal.
Yeah.
And he's got the kind of down-home Texas kind of like straight-talking thing, but he can't straight-talk to himself right now. And so he needs something more than just the kind of the knowledge that someone has got his back. Whereas for Cameron, that's all she wants, is the knowledge that someone has got her back, because she doesn't feel like she has that very much. But for Donna, I think Boz is an interesting proposition, because Donna has never looked for that. She had a very strong family. We know that from season one. We know that she had a family who, like, we know her dad was a successful businessman. We know her mum is there for her. You know, she has no problems with her family. Her family are lovely and great, and there's nothing missing. And in many ways, the family that she has a problem with is the family that she's built with Gordon, which kind of goes up and down in terms of its stability. But, you know, in terms of her own background, she's middle class, relatively well off, relatively stable. You know, people have got her back. And so for her, Boz doesn't represent any sort of familial stability. He's just this old dude who's wondering, well, he's not old, but I say that there's somebody who's 41. He is not old. But he's this older dude who has had a career already, gone to prison, come back, doesn't have a discernible skill that Mutiny needs at the moment. Like, yes, they need sales, but actually their big problem is that they don't have the technology to support the sales, right? And they don't have the investment to build the technology and all the rest of it. So they've got sort of issues going. It's interesting that they have a pitch and they don't bring the salesman to the pitch. They go the two women themselves, because they are the company and they're kind of selling themselves as the brand here. So from Donna's point of view, I find, you know, what can they do to create threads between her and Boz? Because they don't need anything from each other. He doesn't need her and she doesn't need him.
And I'm guessing that's why she's never gone out to work at Cardiff.
Yeah, even. Indeed.
You're right. It's been kept separate and uninterested on both sides. And this is the beauty of the show and how everyone is now under that big, chaotic roof. And just to see, there's no room in there. So something's got to give.
Well, actually, while you make that point, you raise a really good point there, which is that Donna could have gone to Cardiff. Like, there were plenty of opportunities for that to happen. And in the end, I think it's down to her that she didn't do that. And so having a piece of Cardiff come back into the project that she has very clearly demarcated as hers and separate from Gordon may have another kind of underlying impact on her. It's like, why are bits of my old life coming into here? But then also to pick up on your everyone under one roof thing, I mean, the tension of that is really made clear when Lev does this fantastically unkind thing. And Cameron tells him to go away. And he's like, oh, I live here. And it's like, oh, God, when you live and work out your problems all in the same chaotic and frankly unhygienic space, like, that is never gonna go anywhere good. And what was interesting about that scene is that I felt like that scene was there to tell us something about Boz, not something about Lev. But I'm not sure that it entirely landed, just in the sense that we already know Boz is quite steely. We already know he can take some shit. He's demonstrated this over and over again. And I don't know that scene told us anything about Boz we didn't already know. I'm not sure it told us anything about Cameron we didn't already know. It told us something about Lev we didn't know, but it wasn't something we needed to know. So I wasn't 100% clear on why that scene needed to be there.
And that's another reversal, isn't it? Because we've seen in, I think it was episode 7 or 6 of the first season, when Boss got everyone into his office to help him on adventure.
Yes, when he got everybody and was like, show me how to get through this thing. Yeah. I remember that.
Yeah. And, you know, I feel like between all of that, this sort of garnered his respect, and that they saw him as this figure. I don't know if that scene was designed to continue to show a side of Cameron that we know, but they may not know of her, because she's been hiding in her office this entire time, not necessarily facing up to problems. Maybe they don't know why there's this relationship sort of brewing in the background that's been there this whole time. It's a tricky one, because I'm with you. It didn't necessarily give us anything from Boss that we didn't already know. And like, we would almost expect them to be writing to each other throughout this time.
I suppose it gives us a sort of window into Cameron's more soft side that maybe that we already have, but maybe the people at Mutiny don't have. But again, it's just sort of like, I don't know that the people at Mutiny needed to see that side of her in that way. I don't know. I liked the way the scene played out, in the sense that it was really well done, and there were a lot of handheld shots that gave it a slight, like, it was inevitable, right? You knew from the minute he started, like, the minute he held up that letter, you knew what was going to happen. But the handheldness of it made it feel a bit fresher, made it feel a little bit more unexpected. It was really well realized, really well performed, beautifully timed, blocked, everything. But I still wasn't sure why it was there. So I think maybe that's kind of the crux of this whole episode for me, is that there's so much in it that I really like. I'm still not clear on exactly why all the bits are here at the moment, but I feel like aside from the fact that I've obviously already invested an entire season in, I feel like even if I started with episode 1 of season 2, this would have been enough to keep me going. Like, I absolutely wouldn't have dropped out at this point. Like, there's plenty being introduced. Realize I do know people who you know, on their rewatches have started from season 2, because they feel like that's when the magic really happens and stuff like that. This would not have lost momentum for me, in the sense of I would have carried on to watch the next episode anyway. But taking it on its own, away from its fellows, there was a slight fracturedness. There was a slight, wait, what's going on over here, that I, as a whole, maybe didn't work so well for me.
So I think the episode is actually designed from a narrative structure to be like this, which sounds really strange. But one of the notes that I've taken are about the fact that, yes, there's a lot going on, but there's a lot going on in the different acts of the actual episode, to the point where it actually feels like it might be dragging on, because you start with Joe. There's clearly a storyline brewing there, but then you have to go to a different character. It feels a bit like Game of Thrones, but to a smaller scale, where there's like 5 different like conflicts in one episode, and you know, you see 10 minutes of one and then that's it. And it kind of feels like that from that point of view, just because you don't get the full beats that you would in a, you know, from other episodes where there's a lot happening, there's a lot of moving forward. And it does really feel like you've got like 2 main storylines in the first half of the episode and 2 different ones by the end of it. And I'm talking about the pitch. I'm talking about Joe starting in this new place. I'm talking about the conversation with like the introduction to Sarah's father. And I think this is where it feels a little bit wonky.
Yes. And I feel like cracking the show open like this is going to be what makes it work. Like, clearly they've sat down and gone, we can't, yes, our thing is understanding these 4 people and their jigsaw, but the only way that's going to work is if we open up their lives a bit further. Because obviously you can't just carry on having these 4 people have circular arguments forever.
No.
So this is going to be what gives it more life. It's kind of like the, when you're growing out a haircut, this is a slightly, slightly messy mid-stage bit where you're experimenting a bit with what makes your hair lengths work. It's like, actually, who are we going to introduce? And I think they are quite careful about who they're bringing into this world and what they add to the dynamics. So Tom, for example, clearly he doesn't like fill a Joe role, but he fills some of the things that some of the impact Joe was having on Cameron. And I think Jacob fills in some of the impact that Joe's absent dad was having on him. And, you know, you've got kind of people pulling strings that they need to pull, but quite carefully. But yeah, we've just kind of got to get to know these people and care about them before we can totally relax.
Let's dive into that for a second.
Yes, because I was going to say there's two more things I think that we really need to talk about, which is Jacob, Joe, all that kind of thing, and then the pitch and what happened there. So let's do Jacob and Joe.
Let's do Jacob and Joe. I think something that was really interesting to me, and I think it really brought it back to the Texas of it all, is how there is this admiration for the industry that he works in and that he probably helped not build because it's oil, but he probably sort of scaled, where he says, you know, you don't want to work somewhere that powers the world. And it's kind of ironic because Joe worked somewhere that powered or could have powered the world through computers, right? So it's really interesting to compare this sort of tech side of things with this more, I want to call it traditional for the lack of a better term, but like more homegrown, pure Texas that does drive a lot of the things that allow some of the other elements, both financially and from other points of view.
Yeah, I mean, literally, Joe's industry can't exist without Jacob's, right? The power that it takes to power computing, literally, the electricity that sits underneath these servers and all the rest of it, it is coming from fossil fuels.
Yeah.
For now. And certainly was at the time. I think it presents such an interesting dynamic in terms of people who pride themselves in creating the building blocks of things and people who pride themselves in moving on and discovering new things and like, who are those people now that Joe isn't who he used to be? So a couple of things in this. First of all, the aircraft hangar set is incredible.
Yes.
And weird and symbolic and all these things. And off center, like half of those shots felt like I was on a ship. The whole thing was madness.
One of the things that I took down was the geometry of it all. Like you couldn't have a scene in that whole act without just shapes coming out of from the plane, from the hangar, from them, from the objects behind. It was bizarre and it was kind of like, off-putting isn't the right word, but it kind of took you out of the normal settings that we find ourselves in, right? Because this kind of meets with someone that's powerful, like you would think it would be like over dinner or if it was a more formal setting over like a boardroom, not in a hangar. I don't know. It was entertainingly odd. I kind of did enjoy it.
And I should point out at this point, actually, because it's one thing we haven't mentioned, that we've got a new director on board for this episode. So obviously, first episode, we welcomed back your countryman, the great Juan José. This time we've got Phil Abraham, who is a cinematographer and director who is best known, actually, for his work on The Sopranos and Mad Men. And so he came in and I think really embraced actually the off kilter, the handheld. And I think he took the kind of Campanella style and really embraced it. And it felt right. It felt very much in the style that we've seen so far.
He breaks it actually. So one of the things I wrote is he breaks the rules of actually cinematography, which is quite interesting. When Joe goes into his first day of work in his new place, he's kind of like completely out of the frame. And the point is obviously to contrast massively pace against this more massive building. And then he ends up in the basement, like he's, you know, it couldn't be clear that he's nothing. But it was such an interesting scene because he's just weirdly out of frame, which we don't see a lot of. And then sort of the tilt takes you out of it. And I thought that was really interesting because it kind of really worked to that effect. And again, very impressive to be able to break the boundaries like that to sort of prove this point.
I loved everything about the whole basement revelation. I loved it from the point of view of the visuals. Like, and actually the basement has really strong Cardiff vibes with a kind of like sickly, greeny, industrial, like, oh God, Joe's back
folder.
Joe's back in one of these environments that are kind of like not exactly conducive to creativity. They're a bit too factory for that.
Yeah.
And it's all a bit gray and, you know, you get introduced to his manager who is like almost comically awful. And he's, you know, he's this huge guy in this very low ceilinged, oppressive little basement. So I loved it visually. What I loved actually that it revealed in the storytelling. So again, I should mention the script for this episode is Jonathan Liskow, who has surfaced in season one as well. So he's obviously been working on this for quite a while, knows these characters well. And what I find interesting is that at no point does Joe attempt to BS Sarah about what's going on. Not only does he reveal immediately what's happened, but he goes, it's fine. Like, don't fight this battle for me. I'll deal with it. It's okay.
But what I thought was weird was that she would expose things about her past relationship just casually over the phone in that conversation. Like, you, again, you would almost, it was like, that was a little bit too much. Like, can you wait until you get home before you say that your ex-husband, like, conned your father out of, like, a lot of money?
I mean, I'm assuming that Joe already knew that and she's just kind of recapping it for the purposes of the script. Yeah, this script can only go so far. Like, we can't have that many scenes in one episode.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, they could have had that as Joe coming home and talking to her face, but I kind of liked the distance.
Yeah.
I liked the fact that he was doing it from the office, and it kind of lets you into the kind of petty, small-minded bureaucracy of the world that he's now in. It was fascinating to me from a kind of Joe character development point of view that I feel like the old Joe would have been much quicker to walk out, would have been much quicker to get offended and go and throw punches, would have been much quicker to lie about it to his other half. Like, I don't know if it had been Cameron. I don't know if he would have been able to say, your dad shoved me in the basement. This is the question, is Joe new Coke? Is new Joe a flavor that we're going to like? Or is he going to be roundly rejected?
It's weird to think of him as new Joe just because it feels like there's something bubbling up. You know what I mean? I feel like all the other characters have somehow taken on new roles and are just kind of sticking to it. I guess that could be the theme of the episode. Just stick through it, kind of try and see it through. And we see this with Donna, with Cameron, with Boss to an extent. And with Joe, I just kind of don't believe it.
No. And it feels like the other characters taking on new roles are becoming more themselves. Like, Donna taking on this more Gordon-like role is showing signs of herself that we saw hints of that are just becoming more dominant. And Cameron is still Cameron. Like, yeah, we're seeing a few more facets of her, but, you know, she's still becoming more herself. The two that are really struggling with is Joe, because it doesn't feel genuine. You're like, okay, but where's the real Joe? We've seen too much drama from the guy that blew up the computers to think this is going to be real and lasting. And in Gordon's case, it's not that he is not, he is definitely becoming more himself. He is definitely becoming more Gordon. The problem with Gordon is that he doesn't know where he's going or what he's doing. So for him, it's a different dynamic again, because he, like, I have to say, that feeling when he buys all the kit, he opens it, he sets it all up, and then
yes,
he sits down and he doesn't have a clue what to do after that. My heart absolutely sank. I've been there 100 times when you're like, oh, I'm going to write the novel when I buy a new laptop, and I'm going to do the thing when I do the thing. And it never do. You get all the stuff together, you buy all the thing, and then you go,
I'm waiting for my new camera and two lenses. So
I mean,
I get it.
I finally come to the realization that, you know, I can have all the sewing equipment in the world, but I'll only sew when I feel like sewing.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's one of those things. But I loved that sequence. I loved the quick shots. I loved the music. It felt very, very 80s. There was something kind of like really quintessentially 80s about that whole montage of him unpacking stuff and setting it up. But then the kind of like bleeping cursor, and you're just like, oh, I really felt for him. Like, I think it's the first time in a season and a bit that I genuinely bonded with Gordon for a second and went, oh, crap, man, I know where you are.
Yeah. And then I guess the Coke element is like, oh, he's going to be unpredictable, even more so than usual, right?
Yeah.
And
that's where he lost me, because that's not my way of dealing with a mental block.
Well, I don't want to make these comparisons because they're kind of like maybe out of line, but The Queen's Gambit, I don't know if you've seen it yet.
I haven't. I'm the only person left who hasn't, I think.
Watch it. And she's half Argentinian. So if you want to continue this thread.
That's true.
There's obviously like a substance abuse element to the entire show. And it kind of feels like this to an extent, where basically if she takes these pills, she can project pieces on the ceiling and she can map out place and stuff like that. So
yeah. It
does feel like the whole thing is like, you know, how good are you versus what these substances help you achieve, what's already there but heightened. And it kind of felt like that a little bit, because suddenly he takes a Coke and he's like doing all these things.
Yes.
But again, how believable is it? I don't know, because I don't know if it's to enable and to unlock that power in him, or if it's an excuse or, you know, something to sort of numb you more than anything else.
There are so many reasons why this episode is called New Coke, but obviously that's one of the other ones. Is, you know, is this actually a revelation for Gordon? Is it unlocking anything? Is it untapping anything? Or is it just heightening and exacerbating the complete chaos that his mind is already in? And obviously Coke is also a very 80s associated drug. Like, it's not like people have stopped taking it, but it is.
Oh, yeah.
There were a lot of films about it. It was focused on a lot of things. And this did feel like a very 80s episode in a way that, like, we've always talked about how this show does its period setting in subtle ways. Like, okay, sometimes it has really obvious markers like the Cabbage Patch Kid, but it still winds them in neatly. It's not kind of like really obvious visual cues. A lot of the time, the fact that the show doesn't do very many establishing shots or things like that is also means that it doesn't do kind of like kid walking down the street in Ghostbusters costume kind of stuff. So, but this whole episode style really brought the 1985-ness of it out. And one area actually that IMDb picked up on that I didn't was Cameron looking at the pictures at the pitch, and somebody said, oh, that's a callback to Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And I was like, is it? Oh my God, yeah, maybe it is. And they point out that, you know, that you've got Cameron, and then it was Cameron and Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And I think somebody even goes, oh, that's where she got her name. I have no idea if that's where she got her name, but if she did, you cannot find, I know you haven't seen Ferris Bueller's Day Off, but you cannot find two Camerons who are less alike.
Now I need to.
Like, I am spiritually very much a Cameron Fry. I do not like to break the rules. I do get stressed out, and I would not do that to my dad's car. But although my dad is lovely and nothing like his dad. But I didn't see that. And once they pointed it out, I was like, there's so much in this episode that feels like it was made then. The kind of quick montage of the kit unpacking, the bit with the images in the gallery. It just, it's like, I feel like all the people involved in this episode loved the 80s-ness of it.
Totally. And you're right. I mean, there's something about seeing like an unpacking of an 80s computer. Like, yeah, we didn't have YouTube back then. So it is really interesting to see that the colors and all the stuff that you've already pointed out. And I think we can go into the pitch, because I feel like that was also very 80s from like a narrative point of view.
Yes, because for the first time, we've had hints of sexism stuff brewing before, like when, you know, like that the episode where I was kind of uncomfortable with Cameron and Donna like bitching at each other. We've had like undercurrents of that. And now it's like, no undercurrents. We're going to like serve it up on a platter in front of you and go, this guy is going to outright ask you if you're going to have babies and ruin his business.
If you have biological imperatives.
And I found that really interesting. It's like, I suppose we had to deal with it at some point, and we can't have two women setting up a business in 1985 who don't come across any sexism, because that is just unrealistic.
But it was interesting to see it just be blurted out like that, and them even be like, what? Are you serious right now? Because I think that was like one thing is for there to be like an undercurrent and then them not really pick up on it and just go away and think, did we just get screwed over for, you know, having uteruses? But it's like first that, and then it's, oh, but your games are repetitive and it's boring, and actually you haven't shown me this or that, how many uses you've got. But the whole first scene when Cameron arrives to meet Donna and she's kind of bitching at her for not telling her how she should dress was hilarious, because one, it was funny, and two, it was like, Cameron, like, you're an adult. Like, you don't need, like, why would you show up the same way you show up everywhere else for a pitch to get money? And this is so, I thought it was so great, because it really highlights how Cameron thinks that people should just bend to her will. Like, oh, these guys will give us money because I made a great product. And it's like, that's not how it works.
No, but what I loved about their reaction to this guy was they looked disgusted, but they didn't look surprised.
Yeah.
And that balance was absolutely spot on. It's like, we kind of knew you'd be thinking that, but we're disgusted that you said it out loud. And yeah, you're right. Cameron turning up to the pitch, like not even having thought about what to wear, And they obviously haven't talked about it as well. So it's not just like, oh, why didn't you say something? It's like they didn't even consider talking about it. Like to Donna, it was just really obvious that you turn up looking like you mean business. To Cameron, it was just it's really obvious that you just turn up being yourself. And it's the first time you see Cameron like not quite sure that she's made the right decision, actually. Like she's not sure of herself there. And it reminded me slightly of, I remember the agency we both worked at once unexpectedly being asked to lunch by a client and going with my then manager, who is like basically the most elegant person on earth. And I looked like crap that day. Like I really looked like crap. And I was like, manager lady, I look terrible. Is this right? How we want to look in front of clients? And she was like, oh, it's fine. You work for a creative agency. You're in the creative end of things. No one expects people to look like well turned out. And I loved that because she reassured me. But at the same time, I was like, I think when you're a girl, they do, though. I think when you're a man, it maybe not. But when you're a girl, they do.
I mean, even I still struggle with that today. It's like, oh, creative entertainment industry. But you still get sort of people commenting. I mean, I remember working in the same agency, having to fly to client meetings in Switzerland. It's like, it doesn't matter what you do. It's about how they dress. And like, I remember them saying, like, if you don't come with a suit and tie, the manager wouldn't even look at you when you're pitching something. And you kind of have to transform for these settings and to, in a way, speak the language. And this is where Joe was great, right? The tie. I mean, he knew exactly how to be in those circumstances, but I get it only because he had been brought up in those circumstances.
Absolutely. But I think when it comes to Donna and Cameron, there is that extra layer now, right? So what is professional business wear for a woman? Like for a man, it's turn up in a suit, okay? Turn up in a suit, shave,
yeah, totally.
Brush your hair, make sure it's not too long. But for Cameron and Donna, it's like, it's not only just can you turn up looking businesslike, but the right level of attractive, right? You can't look too...
Well, yeah, you can't tempt them.
You can't look too sexy because then you're not serious. But if you don't look, you know, attractive enough, then they're not interested because you are, you know, yeah, unshaggable or whatever. And it's, you know, these kind of undercurrents of not just like, should I wear business wear or casual wear, but exactly what level of business wear is okay, are really kind of coming through in the kind of undercurrents. And I thought that was really well done, actually. I liked that whole scene, just made me kind of want to pull out my own intestines and strangle myself with them. It was so awkward and so well done. Yeah, I'd like to not have to watch it again, but I also really enjoyed it.
No, I also enjoyed it. And I think it continues to add these crumbs, right? These markers that there's an outside world that they're competing in, because I think we forget that. We think that Cameron and Donna are the only ones doing these amazing games, online technology, first to play when it comes to what Donna thinks could be an amazing idea. But then you have Tom being like, oh, you're slow. I've already seen this and that somewhere else. You got this guy saying, oh, so-and-so are offering more things. And you got Cameron understanding that actually having all these skills is just not enough. You need funding and you need eventually other people's input, because they are also putting money into your ideas and into your business. And so I think it's almost like as her world gets bigger, Joe's gets smaller.
Absolutely. And I think that there's... the Cameron side of things also brings out something that we're still seeing. We're seeing kind of writ large today, which is the tension between creators and consumers. So these days, we are now sadly used to the idea that fans can throw a tantrum and get a film changed or get a new version of a film that it's 4 hours long and no one wants to see. Yeah. And you know what film I'm talking about. So, you know, we get the kind of... It happens mostly in the very fandom-y, Star Wars-y, Marvel-y, DC type communities. But you get the idea of the kind of like, we buy your product, we fund your product, therefore we own it. And then you get that tension between the creator who...
You work for us, yeah.
Yeah, the creator who is like, yeah, but I came up with this and I can do what I want with it because it's... Or, you know, I was put in charge of this, so I can do what I want with it. And... to some extent, Cameron is now finding that tension because the truth is somewhere in between, right? Obviously, the creator has this kind of vision for their creation and their product. But if there's no one who wants it, or if there's no one who wants it in the long term, you can't sell it. And Cameron wants to make money out of her creativity. Not because she wants to be rich, but because she wants to have enough money to do...
She wants to grow,
yeah, right? She wants to have enough money to do more creativity. All Cameron really wants is to be able to bankroll doing whatever she wants. She's obviously not fussed about spending the money on herself. I don't mean that in a kind of like bitchy way, but she doesn't care about clothes, trappings, you know, doing up the house, whatever. She cares about, can I get more lines of data or whatever? You know, she cares about building network capacity and having time to create new stories and all that kind of thing. So, but she's aware that you need money or to keep, you know, stealing from the neighbors if you're going to do that. So she's come into that tension now where Tom has come along from the point of view of consumer and gone, you are no longer giving people what they want. You did. And now you're trying to wring more and more out of the same cloth, and you can't keep doing that. You can't, every it's all diminishing returns now, right? It's kind of like an olive press. You've got the extra version stuff, and now you're getting to the blended dregs now.
Yeah. And you should have been ahead of this dynamic and this sort of product cycle where you actually created this sort of like episodic product that you then need to, you created a hunger for it that you need to feed.
Yeah. And as a visionary, you should be spending more time envisioning. Yeah.
Well, I don't know, but I don't know what she wants, because you kind of get the impression that while she's holed up doing this same thing, or you get the impression, because I don't know if she's working that hard, to be honest with you, versus like just, I don't know, being in this holding pattern, because Donna's out there, like there could be a really interesting community product here. Everyone else is trying to figure out how to keep the place running smoothly, the servers, all that stuff. And she's just like hung up on this thing, and you just don't really know what she wants. She doesn't want to be a boss. She doesn't want to be a manager. She doesn't want to be a coach. She doesn't want to be a leader. She doesn't want to be a salesperson.
But she also doesn't want to be told what to do. So, which by nature makes you the boss.
So. And Donna said that sort of several times. And I love her speech about like, next time you do this, you can factor in my salary because I'll be leaving if you make another decision like this without me. So I think it's going to be really interesting this season to see what she wants and what she needs to get through that innovation. Like, is she after this endless pursuit of innovation? Is she after just these like momentary highs that get you these sparks and then you just do it and you get it out there? And this is what I mean. Like, it's hard because she...
Is that her cocaine? Her dopamine rush?
Exactly. Like, what is it? What is it going to get you? No, and the last thing that I wanted to mention in terms of like camera work, lighting, et cetera, is that there's some really nice natural lighting taking place. It seems like every time they're outside, they're in like right before, it's kind of like golden hour. It's ripe. It's after a day's work, basically. And when Don and Cameron are confronting Tom, their faces are half lit by the sun and there's shadow there. There's all these trees because they're outside and it's very suburban, which I still find fascinating, like how suburban everything is where they are. And I just think that was kind of, again, refreshing to get them out there and have the lighting be natural, but still a little bit purposeful, because you don't know how they're going to come out of that confrontation, right? It can go one or two ways, and you can see in their face how the lighting makes it so that it kind of split in what's going to happen next.
Absolutely. I think that just, it's actually a very beautiful episode in many ways. We talked about the colors and the different, you know, lighting changes and all things like that. You talked about kind of breaking the cinematography rules as Joe goes into the building. I also love that. I think the last time we see Joe in this episode, he's standing under the exit sign on the phone, which I thought was like, do you want to lay on the symbolism any thicker? But also I really appreciated it.
That symbolism is like, you know, lay it on thick so long as you then help us push that forward, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, this brings us to the end of New Coke. I'm looking forward to seeing if the next episode is more like New Coke or the first one, or completely different.
And I have to say, when we went into this episode, I actually felt like there wasn't so much that we were going to talk about, but I think we have actually wrung every little bit out of it. I'm surprised by how much kind of kept coming to me as I was talking about it. Definitely an interesting one. Guys, thank you for sticking with us, or if you're new here, welcome. You can find us on Twitter under TTTGYTTT, which if you think about it is the initials of the show. And lovely, almost a palindrome, but not quite.
And you can find us in any of your podcast app of choice. We are also now on YouTube, believe it or not. So there's no excuse not to find us and listen. But if you do, We'd really appreciate it. And leave us a review while you're at it so you can challenge some of our opinions and we can introduce more of those into the show going forward.
Take care.